Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
The topic today, book reviewing, is one that, addressed by an academic or an author, all too often deteriorates into paying off some grievances or such matters. So let's start by adopting an optimistic pose or a different pose. And what I would like to suggest, first of all, is that we are in an age, we may like or dislike it, but we are in an age of a democratization of reviewing, in a situation in which readers, or indeed those who can't be bothered to read and may only just have seen the title, can play, or on the other hand, people making mature reflection after a careful thought, can readily post their remarks anywhere on a book's website, on their website, on an author's website, wherever they are able to gain access. And where large numbers of people do so, one could say that reviewing is very present. And indeed, whatever criticism one might have of the situation in Britain or the United States, one only has to look at authoritarian states such as China or Russia, Iran or Cuba, to realize that the pleasures or pitfalls of book reviewing in our country is very different to the situation in many others. Secondly, there is a significant development in the activity of what one might call the continual book review, namely the book club. Book clubs in Britain are reputed to have several million members. There's no accurate figures on this, not least because there is, again, thankfully, we are not an authoritarian society, no need to check with your local secret policeman that you're allowed to have a book club and that you're allowed to choose your book. But nevertheless, these are in effect book reviewing processes. So I would like to start off by saying that I welcome this situation. I am a Democrat. I believe that democratization of institutions and practices are a good thing in themselves, and also a good thing relative to what one sees as the absence of freedom, more particularly in other societies, but also, alas, in our own society, where what is often called wokery or political correctness tends to include an intention that you should read some authors and with certain consequences. So the more people that reject that, the better. What I want to add to the contribution is just some personal reflections from my own perspective, and in doing so, as an author and a reviewer, offer a number of insights into the process which aren't always apparent. So let's start off with the obvious point of how a book gets written and, if you like, processed through a system. And in this case, I think one can differentiate between books that go through a formal process of review involving what is known as peer group evaluation and those which don't. Now, the latter group, I mean, you can publish a book yourself, you can do the equivalent, which is persuade an agent to flog it to their personal friends, in which, irrespective of your lack of merit, because you're a celebrity, you will get published. Those books are not the ones I'm thinking about, because there is no real review process in them. What I am thinking about is the situation in which many books are published, in which a synopsis has to be produced. This synopsis is sent to review, generally by two or three people. They then produce anonymous reviews, which are fed back to the author, sometimes with a go away, sometimes with a this is excellent, more often actually than the last, with a we need the following revisions. If the author then gets contracted, most books are with no financial advance. There is no commitment by the publisher other than to just look at the book when it comes in. When it comes in, a book is usually then read again in a similar fashion by two or three people, as well as by the commissioning editor within the publishing house. And a last group, and one I'm familiar with, if there is a general editor of a series, he or she will also read it. So that's another aspect of reviewing. These are in some respects the most helpful reviews. They are reviews which can be as long as the reviewer likes, whereas in contrast, if you're reviewing in a newspaper or a periodical, there are generally quite clear templates on length. So I've just done a review for the Journal of Military History. It expects 800 words. Were I to write a longer review, I would have to make a jolly good case, and probably I'd be told, don't rock the boat, everybody else will want to do the same, paper costs money. But that is not the case, in fact, with peer group reviews, which are generally unwelcome if they are very short, and unwelcome by the publisher if they simply appear to give a perfunctory nod. To the author, they are extraordinarily helpful because they can lead to quite clear need to rethink what they're saying, either because error is detected or, more commonly, because the reviewer suggests that maybe things like, it's happened to me recently, chapter 10 should come before chapter 8, this sort of thing, which is very helpful and forces you to think, are you happy with the existing structure? Do you agree or do you not agree? So that process is one that most readers of books possibly are insufficiently familiar with. On top of that, most authors, as they acknowledge in their preface, will also ask acquaintances, friends, and fellow experts to review them themselves. Now, that process can also be extraordinarily helpful. I always find it particularly helpful if the reviewer is critical, because then again, they draw attention to possibly weaknesses one was not aware of, either in what one's covered or in what one hasn't covered or in how one has said it. All of those are really helpful. Now, what this is leading towards is, as you will appreciate, the sense that the most valuable aspect of reviewing are those which most people are not familiar with. In other words, these often nuanced, private, sometimes very critical, sometimes not so critical, sometimes signed, sometimes not signed. But all of them are important in the improvement of text and the clarification of ideas. And one of the reasons, in my view, why so many trade books, books that have not gone through a review process, are so very, very, very weak, is that it is quite clear that the author has not, as it were, put them forward to scrutiny by people who are outside their friendship group before the book is actually submitted, let alone before it is published. And I'm afraid to say that many of the books that readers may see in airport newsstands or decorating the tables of Waterstones, where, as most listeners are aware, publishers often pay for the books to be there, many of those books are not actually terribly good or worth reading as a consequence. The other key is, if a book claims to be or is proclaimed to be definitive, don't bother with it. There is no such thing as a definitive study. Life does not stand still with all knowledge summarized at a particular moment. Now, we then move to the more formal processes, which people may be accustomed to simply by the matter of picking up their newspaper or reading it online or the equivalents. And podcasts and such like. And these are reviews, and I suppose I can talk about it a little extent because I am both an author and a reviewer. And here one can offer what one thinks is useful to look for, both as an author and as a reviewer. So let's start. As an author, most authors the main thing they hate is to be ignored. It's not so much because they're narcissists, some may be, some may not be. It's more because they've put a lot of work into a project, they'd like to think it is important, and they find it disappointing if it isn't seen in that light. And sometimes they're irritated or irritable when they see works of less merit instead get attention. So one has to see both, you know, reasonable motives and other ones which, whilst understandable, don't take us very far. As an author, one of the consequences, therefore, of being reviewed is there can be considerable pleasure in being, as it were, criticized. I was once vilified by somebody. What a surprise, a man called Wagner, who's at Queen Mary College. What a surprise. I had been somewhat critical of a book of his. And he then, as it were, crossed the road, by which it means clearly made an effort to persuade the Guardian to allow him to denounce me at length. And I was delighted. I was absolutely delighted. First, because I didn't rate him, second, because I don't rate the Guardian, and third, because here was a lot of attention. And I very much hope that he and the Guardian will attack me on other occasions. It will give me a lot of pleasure. So there is this sense, first, that authors dislike being ignored. When they then look at reviews that are written of them, whether those are published or not published, whether they're in the review process or not, there can also be enormous amount of amusement as to what people say. I can recall a book on Parliament and foreign policy in the 18th century written by yours truly. It went in and it had been commissioned by Cambridge University Press. They sent it to a reader who was anonymous, but who announced that the clear failing was that I had failed to read or cite the work of Kathleen Wilson. I'm afraid I had read it. I just didn't think it was very good or pertinent in this particular case. Anyway, I then took enormous pleasure in, as it were, paraphrasing the reader's comment and then adding that into the preface to say you could argue X, Y, and Z, but obviously that was misleading for the following three reasons. Now, so in other words, you can have innocent amusement as an author in, as it were, the reviewers patting themselves, praising themselves, and classically saying the book should have been written as they would have wanted to write it, which is fine, in which case, why the hell didn't they bloody well do it already? Instead of criticizing somebody whose perspective, scholarship is different, and whose insights, are not those that they would like. So that can be very funny. What else might one say? Well, I suppose that this day and age, given that many authors are, the remuneration is very, very low. You can look up the figures published by the Authors Licensing and Collecting Society if you don't believe me. It is amazing how low they are. And obviously, some people are also pursuing jobs, not just as academics, but maybe as archivists or other professions in which their publication may be important to them. So I imagine in those cases, they would be very upset if the reviews were poor. Let me reassure them. Most sensible people realize that actually the sort of critical reviews, while they can be important, and I'd like to think that of some of the ones I've written, maybe I'm wrong, but whilst they can be important, very rarely go to the extent of trying to close down the debate. Now, you do get that with some people on the political and cultural extremes, but most people, if they say this book should have included a survey of the French situation, or it's a great pity that in devoting so much time to, say, the Archives étrangères, they didn't look at the Archives de la Marine. That's not to say don't bother here. It's to really say to the author, actually, you know, you could possibly do a bit better next time. Maybe if you're doing another edition or another work, maybe you should do that. But it is not going any further than that. So most authors, if they are sensible, know that it's nice to be reviewed, that there is always a process that is to a degree is random. And listeners will understand it is particularly random because those people who know about the subject tend to be the academic reviewers and therefore are unable to write for some of the major publications that might review them. And indeed, it has to be said that most publications, including Graham the Critic, often produce reviewers who really aren't up to it and really shouldn't be asked. And one can only assume that's not because they're chums of the editor, but because the people who were really good were unable to do so. One doesn't know. One hopes that the critic can manage better in the future. Anyway, if one then thinks about the perspective from the issue of the reviewer and what the reviewer should be trying to do, I would argue that it's not the reviewer's job to say how they would have written the book. It is the reviewer's job to, as it were, debate with the author the, as it were, perspectives from which they are writing, from the context or in the context of being another informed, thoughtful, scholarly individual, and with a history book, somebody that has done detailed archival work. It's a waste of time reading reviews written by people that haven't done detailed archival work because they don't know the kind of interpretations that archival research might encourage. And in the last point, before I hand over to you, Graham, one might indeed add that history as a subject is by its nature one that is, how should one put it, unfixed. We cannot repeat the experiment. So the book, which argues tentatively and admits doubt, is the very best of books. And hopefully the reviewer, I don't always match this, but hopefully the reviewer, who is also able to understand that and to look for that, and if they find it, to praise it, and if they don't find it, to attack the glib certainties of the writer, hopefully that is what the reader, the reviewer should be doing, and the reader of reviews should be searching for. Over to you, Graham.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Professor Black. I want to start, if I may, with the part of reviewing that the reader often doesn't see, which is to say the peer review part of the process. I wonder if you can just explain a little bit further. Is this peer review process done primarily for, is it directed at the editor of the book or at the writer? So, is it being written towards the person responsible at the publishing end, making suggestions, or is it more a direct correspondence with the writer?
Well, that's an excellent question. There's both. In other words, any good writer, and you've written a lot of good books, any good writer will ask those people who they feel they can ask. They may be friends, they may not be friends, they may be academics where there is a degree of mutual respect, and they'll ask them for comments themselves before they submit it to the publisher. So those comments are clearly going to the author. But separately, when the book goes in to the publisher, then the editor, as you say, will commission reports which will go to the editor, and if the editor considers it pertinent, and generally they consider it very pertinent, they will, quote, share them with the author. That does not mean they will share the identity of them. There's one other group, which I'm afraid, you know, I failed to mention, which was, again, a matter of personal acquaintance, as it were. I did edit for 16 years a journal. And in that position, I commissioned reviews as well. And again, there you are, in a sense, the position, a different position as editor, but you also realize that you are hopelessly dependent on the goodwill of your potential contributors, because on the whole, you can't pay them anything. And nevertheless, they still do a lot of work.
I'm conscious you said that you found getting constructive criticism in this period of the peer review very helpful and useful. Do you think there is, though, a danger that, given that different academics, particularly when they're in the same field of study, often have very conflicting views, and there can even be personal animus involved. Is there the danger, though, that you get someone who just takes a totally different view to you, and really it's criticism, but not of the constructive kind. Particularly when editors receive that kind of level of rather kind of comprehensive assault on the concept of a book. What tends to happen in that situation? Do you just find out another peer reviewer, or could that potentially be curtains for the book?
Well, you're absolutely right. It can be curtains for the book, which is a great pity. And my own view is you should only go to that stage if you've specifically discussed the matter with the author, who, after all, has done a lot of work, unpaid. And, you know, it should not be, as it were, thrown away like a piece of chewing gum on the sole of somebody's shoe. You're absolutely right. It can be very, very interesting. I mean, in the 1980s, I recall writing an article on British foreign policy in the early 1740s. And it was for a Canadian journal, which incidentally eventually published it, a scholarly journal. And they sent it out to three anonymous reviewers who produced completely different, divergent reports, from extraordinarily pro to actively hostile. And the editor was so taken aback by this that he, or she, I can't remember whether it was a he or a she, wrote to me, enclosed them, and said, well, what do you make of that? And in case you think that's just a case of me, I can recall the University of Cambridge contacting me after a disputed viva process in which the two examiners, both highly distinguished, more distinguished than me, incidentally, or more politically powerful within the profession, I suppose that's what you mean by distinguished, had come to violently different views on a doctorate and had complained about each other to the faculty board. And because I was a subject specialist as well, they wrote to me, they sent me the thing, they said there's going to be not another viva, but the committee would like you to advise on whether you think this should be published or not, accepted or not, and also why is it that there can be such divergent views, which I thought showed a great cleverness as well as interest on the part of the University of Cambridge faculty board at that stage, or its committee at any rate. I think you're right. Unfortunately, a lot of people do, as it were, judge the individual rather than the piece of scholarship, which is not terribly helpful. The same individual can produce work. I'm certainly true of me. Some of my work is better than others. Some of the work improves by being revised yet again, because I always revise several times. And I think the same thing must be true of other people. I can't believe they're not in the same boat. So it's not always the case that a highly critical review is a matter of personal animus, but often it is. And I think it's fair to say that as a series editor, and I've edited over seven series in the past, and as a journal editor, and indeed as a member of several prize, book prize committees, I am uneasily aware that all too often people, it tends to be sort of weaker people, are very critical. And I'll give you an observation which I noticed as a teacher. I sat on exam boards from my appointment in 1980 thereafter, and this may surprise you because I can have quite a caustic tongue, but I actually was generally the most sympathetic examiner by far, first at Durham and then at Exeter and as an external. And what I noticed was that the people who were most unsympathetic were generally those who were fairly mediocre. They particularly those that hadn't got firsts themselves or had obviously struggled incredibly hard to get a first. And they obviously thought that in order to do well, you had to be absolutely, enormously, exceptionally fabulous. And I took the view that this was ridiculous, that what we were doing was taking part in a technical exercise, which was awarding marks. I didn't feel any lack of confidence in my own intellectual situation, for the record, not that it makes me a better person. I got a starred first. And I did think that the process was a bit ridiculous. And I see the same thing elsewhere in the profession. You know, the sort of, I remember once a rather mediocre person who was in a senior position in my faculty saying that nobody who was any good, could take less than 10 years to write a book, which was hilarious because they had taken 10 years and their book was generally regarded as not particularly good. And, you know, one was reminded unerringly of the Joseph II comment in Amadeus, you know, too many notes directed at Mozart. But I think that there is, as you say, a degree in which the review process can enable people who are not particularly gifted. And after all, the expansion, the massive expansion in the number of firsts at universities mean that people who would no way have become academics have become academics instead, certainly for 30 years. And maybe these people actually, as it were, use the process to reward their malice. If so, what a pity. But fortunately now, there are other opportunities. Ultimately, if you cannot appear in the in print, and I would think that quite a lot of very good work is possibly not going to appear in print because it's not, as it were, either going to meet the fashionable academic standards of the day or the commercial exigencies. But fortunately, there are other mediums now in which this work can appear.
Just a final question, if I may, about the reviews that people see in print. I'm always struck by how much cynicism there is, maybe justifiably, but how much cynicism there is about book reviews. A very good book review is always presumed to have been written by the author's nephew or some close friend, whereas a very negative review is seemed to have been some kind of academic jealousy or payback for some real perceived slight from a previous time. Also, main newspapers, they review books, and then often you can buy the book directly from the the newspaper's online bookshop, which leads to some people think that good reviews are done deliberately by the newspaper to then get sales through their retail offering. Can you just kind of throw some light on that for readers who generally have such a low opinion of reviews in journals and magazines, in newspapers, that they actually prefer the kind of the wisdom of crowds, of the kind of TripAdvisor style reviews left at the bottom of Amazon and such sites?
Well, I think journals are better than newspapers. So although I made a critical remark about The Critic earlier, and indeed I do think that you could raise the quality of some of your reviews and reviewers, nevertheless, most of them are worth reading. And I think I would also say the same about journals which have never published me. I've never published in the Literary Review, as far as I'm aware. Certainly if I have, it's not for over two decades. I still think that what they publish is interesting. I haven't appeared in the TLS ever since I think late 1979, but I still think some of their reviews are good, although the London Review of Books is far too faddish. So I think, and obviously if you're looking at more serious weighty things, English Historical Review, Journal of Modern History, Journal of Military History, American Historical Review, are all in my view well worth reading. Newspapers I'm less happy with. I actually recently had an episode with a major newspaper, we could call it The Times, in which they commissioned me to review Caroline Elkin's very poor book on violence at the end of the British Empire. They didn't like the review, which was quite critical of the book. They asked me to review it, to rewrite it. I amplified what I had to say, and they ditched it, which is absolutely their prerogative. You know, they're not obliged to publish a review, and it would be narcissistic of me to think otherwise. But I do think they might have actually chosen to draw attention to the way they were, in effect, censoring what they published. If you look at The Times, it's bizarre, for example, or interesting, the number of occasions in which their journalists get reviewed, and not always are the books necessarily appropriate or particularly original. And, you know, one can say that at one of their major journalists who writes quite a lot. So I'm a bit more wary of newspapers. I would say that monthlies and weeklies are much, much, much better. And I would say that the scholarly side tends to be really excellent. I mean, I would always, I mean, I was saying this at a school, I was talking at a school on Wednesday. And, you know, pupils are busy. They've got, these were sixth formers, they've got a number of subjects to carry, cover in A-level. And I said to them, well, it's always worth, if you don't have the time to read, the big books, to at least read the reviews in the serious journals. And that, I think, is worth doing. And I would say that I think it is important to get some flavour of the idea, and this is what I would urge primarily to our listeners, Graham, that what you want to understand is that all scholarship, and indeed all commentary on it, so what we're talking about now, there are differing viewpoints. And there are other ways to look at it. I mean, I myself believe that you should judge a book on its merit, not on its author. I don't believe you should reduce an author to some kind of, they would say that because they're white or black, British or Russian, middle class or working class. I think that is appalling and stupid as an approach, that kind of reductionism. Somebody else might try and argue in its favour. That's fine. There are different points of view. So the best reviews are ones that clarify and highlight the author's perception, and at least lightly invite you to also look at it a different way. They are even more necessary, and here I think one has to be very hard, they are more necessary when the books are by, as it were, people in what one might call the academic equivalent of the blob, who are backing each other, giving each other the Wolfson Prize, promoting each other to some Regis chair or other. And, you know, some of these people are not without merit, and some of their works are not without importance. But there is all too often a habit with these people. One can think of Keith Thomas's very lackluster book on 18th century manners. There is all too, which was, you know, very favorably reviewed by people who knew nothing about the subject. And it was a very unoriginal book. All too often, those individuals are producing work which really you need to put a big question mark to. Lastly, often the very best books of all are debut books. Debut books because the author is often, in the case of historians, and actually I think in many other branches of scholarship, offering a real sort of energy of novelty, but also the ability to draw on often quite a lot of doctoral work. And I think the same thing with novels. Debut novels tend not to have become formulaic. They have a roughness on the edge sometimes, but that is something that is worthwhile. So if listeners are, you know, interested in taking this further, what I would say to them is, if you have a choice, try and read a first book And try and think about it carefully. And lastly, do not be swayed by the titles that somebody has, by the extent to which they may have some powerful position, or that they may have written some prominent book on the back of which you are told they are the definitive scholar on the subject. In my view, there is, with history, there is no such thing as definitive scholarship, and reviews that suggest otherwise are unhelpful and dishonest.
Well, Professor Black, we better not describe this as the definitive guide to book reviews, but it's been a fascinating insight, and I'm sure a lot of listeners who are readers will have gained a sense of what goes on behind the scenes. And for that, I am very grateful. Until next time, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.